our interview with Stephen Cooper.
The acoustic code.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
Can you hear us okay?
Yes, I can hear both of you.
Oh, good.
So, first of all, thank you for participating today. We're really excited to talk to you about your work and some of the things that you've written that we've had the opportunity to read. I'll start by just saying I don't know if you've had a chance to look over what Windwise Radio is, but we have an audience that's very interested in many of the issues that are surrounding industrial wind development. And we actually, our very first program back in February, seems like a long time ago, a lot of shows since then, was with Robert Rand and Stephen Ambrose. Since then, we've had the opportunity to interview Dr. Salt, Alex Salt, about his more recent work and some of the presentations he did at InterNoise in New York City this year. So we do have a history of trying to follow these issues, and we're very interested in what you have to say, and I'm sure that our audience will be also. And I've been looking at your CV a little bit, and I understand that you have quite an extensive background in noise and vibration studies going back many, many years. What brought you to the issues surrounding wind development?
It's actually my wife that's to blame.
Okay.
My son was skiing in the national titles, that is snow skiing, last year, and some other friends who have been friends for a long while were telling her that there was a problem. And what happened was that there were some people that had had a tragic death in the family, and they were still coping with that, and suddenly found that their property was going to be surrounded by turbines, being a number of wind farms, and that they would have something in excess of 400 turbines around them. These people live out in a rural property about a 5.5 hour drive from Sydney. My wife was asked that I do something about noise and could I help them, and that's how it started. And then when I looked into it, I found that there has been a significant injustice that's occurred for the rural community in Australia. And my history of investigation of noise, and particularly industrial noise, makes me go one step further to try and find out what is going on. And I have some pretty sophisticated equipment that allowed me to measure in particular down to very low frequencies that most consultants can't measure. And I went and to a number of residential properties, and my experience says that where you get a large number of complaints, some may have no basis, some definitely will have some basis, and some are questionable. And so I got the view from talking to these residents that A, they weren't mad, B, they were experiencing something that was causing an inconvenience or a significant disturbance to their daily activities. And I just kept on investigating. And that is where I came up with finding evidence both inside and outside residential dwellings of what I have called the wind turbine signature being this periodic pattern associated with the operation of the turbines being nominally 0.8 of a hertz with all the multiple harmonics that are present at every residence that I've been to, and I've now been to 18 of them in Australia for the purpose of testing, and every one of those residents experienced the signature to different degrees. And that's how I sort of got started in it.
Now, I was reading your paper entitled Are Wind Farms Too Close to Communities? And you were writing quite extensively about what you saw as some shortcomings. I wonder if you could explain that for us.
Australia, having developed its environmental criteria after the United States, starts in the general concept of persons more educated about noise, in that for normal environmental criteria, we down here have more stringent limits. For example, if you compare your aircraft noise levels, which are permitted in residential areas, the general criteria for acceptability in Australia is half as loud.
Oh,
and that's very significant when people are involved in from overseas understanding how stringent our criteria are. And so for general industrial noise that's operated throughout the country, they have a criterion that is based upon the ambient background. That's a repeated minimum level plus 5 dB.
So if the noise is more than 5 dB above this ambient background, then it's considered out of bounds?
That is correct for general industrial noise in a city environment.
Okay.
Stephen, I just had a question, because the question is always arises as to what ambient noise level is. Is that L90, or is it some other value?
Okay. In Australia, we have a different definition to the US about ambient. So first off, under our standards, ambient noise is the all-encompassing noise from near and far without the noise source under investigation. So for us, ambient is everything except the wind farm.
So it would be wind noise as well as insects and incidental automobiles and
yes.
Things like that? Oh.
Yes, I'm about to go into that. And we have the definition of background being the repeated minimum of the ambient noise. So whilst the ambient noise will vary in its level up and down, for the purpose of assessing a noise criteria, it's based against the minimum level. So that's what happens generally for noise. And when they do industrial developments, they exclude the wind noise and any measurements where the wind is greater than 5 meters per second. Now, when you come to a turbine situation, obviously there is wind needed to operate the turbines, and therefore they say that as it is fundamental to the operation of a turbine, then they will have a two-part criteria. One is a threshold level. And in Australia, at the present time, it's either 35 dBA or 40 dBA. And then they have a second component, which is background plus 5, being the background level determined for the different wind strengths. So if one is to look at a graph of the criteria, and the horizontal axis is the wind speed, then from the left-hand side of the graph, there is a horizontal line, which is a threshold, until you intersect a line which is going up as it proceeds to the right, or a higher wind strength, to be 5 dB above the background.
Okay.
So you could describe the line as an angle, and the angle from the horizontal to the vertical on the, or the angled on the right, could be, say, 135 degrees.
Right.
So that's the concept that occurs. Now, the problem that we have is that in rural communities or remote dwellings in Australia, the ambient background level, the minimum level, even with light wind blowing, can be below 20 dBA.
Mm-hmm.
So we have very quiet environments, and it's not uncommon in locations to be measuring down to 16 dBA at night outside residential dwellings.
Mm-hmm.
So the concept of a 35 dBA base level is so far above the background that such a noise has to be intruding and disturbing and inappropriate when one compares with the assessment criteria that is used in residential areas.
So How did that come to be? And I mean, is it going to be fixed? I mean, what's the current thinking about how things will go forward with guidelines and regulations? Will they change? Is there a big argument going on right now, or how do you see that?
Well, if it's up to the wind industry, which it suggested had a hand in presenting the guidelines, they would seek to have higher noise levels.
Than even what's existing now?
Oh, well, of course, they want to say that there's no problems and we should have the wind energy and not worry about the noise that occurs. Now, in that regard, all of my papers and the public speaking that I have been to in discussing the wind farm noise, I make the point that I'm not an anti-wind farm advocate. I'm just simply an acoustic engineer. And if you can operate the wind farms without creating a noise disturbance or sleep effect or health impacts, then there would be no objection that I would have on a noise basis to the wind farms. Now, that may mean that if you were 100 kilometres away from a wind farm, obviously you would expect there would be no impact. And if you were 2 kilometres from a wind farm, there will be an impact. So the solution, or the optimum solution to make sure that there are no problems, is somewhere in between. And obviously, I'm not trying to be facetious, but 100 kilometres is most probably a little bit far.
Right.
And 2 kilometres is too close. So it's determining the balance that occurs without causing a problem to the community. And my work is unfunded, so it's work that I fit in when I'm doing my normal consulting work to get to the bottom of this. And I have many requests from communities around Australia to try and help them, because I, some respects, seem to be the lone voice that's been out for their benefit. What we have at the present time is some members of our upper house and in the Commonwealth level, Senators Madigan and Xenophon, have held public meetings in various communities in proximity to wind farms and have been inundated with complaints and personal experiences of disturbance or people leaving their homes. And what has happened is that they have on the statute, at a committee level at the moment, a bill that if a wind farm creates excessive noise, then they will lose their funding under a renewable energy certificate scheme. If you take the funding away, the wind farm cannot survive because it doesn't make its money from selling electricity. It makes it from this renewable energy certificate scheme. And so next Friday, the 2nd of November, is the closing date for submissions on the matter of excessive noise. Now, what is excessive noise at the present time is nominated in the bill as being background plus 10, and that's a bill that's been prepared by politicians, and we're looking at it in terms of acoustically what should the criteria be. And at the present time, and you heard it first, I'm suggesting 25 dBA is the threshold, and then background plus 5, where the background is the noise level determined for the wind speed that the turbines are operating at.
Hmm.
Now, if I have 25 dBA as a criteria, that would seem to accord with the concept of background plus 5 for the majority of the occasions when the turbines are just operating, which seems to be the problem that communities are receiving. They also have problems when they're operating at a high wind speed, but that becomes other factors such as the infrasound or low frequency, which creates an added component to the overall dBA level. One of the issues that I have been reasonably strong in looking at this material is the use of dBA as a general criterion is inadequate for wind farms because it drops off, the curve for the DBA attenuates significantly the low-frequency components. So you could have low-frequency components present, you could have infrasound components present, and they make no difference whatsoever to the DBA level.
Now, you say it's inadequate. Do you really mean it's inappropriate?
No, I say it's actually inadequate. It is inappropriate, but it also is inadequate. Inappropriate could be saying that the level is simply too high. That's one way. But what I'm saying is that it's inadequate because the weighting curve that applies to the DBA level attenuates the blade pass frequency of the turbines by about 170 dB. So when you take that off, the blade pass frequency of the turbines has no impact whatsoever on the overall A-weighted value. So the question becomes, and this is the challenge for acousticians that are looking at this, as to what is the appropriate adjustment or correction or value that you use for looking at these infrasound frequencies because the DBA is inadequate.
And you also, I was reading that you also thought that the G-weighted scale was also not right and maybe it should be an unweighted scale?
Yes, if you look at the G-weighted scale, and you can express it in both a linear and a logarithmic format, and if you place it over the signatures of the infrasound that is generated from operational wind farms, you will see that the G-weighted scale attenuates significantly the blade pass frequency. So if you have the blade pass frequency, and for the purpose of the exercise, call it 0.8 hertz, then the blade pass frequency and the first few harmonics are very critical to what is being received at residential properties and whether those frequencies interfere with the frequencies of the brain for people that are trying to sleep. You have heard things about alpha, beta, delta waves, and they are different frequencies that the brain operates when it's in different states, from being awake to fully asleep. And what has been measured at residents and inside their dwellings are these similar frequencies. So if the G-weighted curve significantly attenuates those frequencies, then the value of the G-weighted level is questionable, and I've been trying to look at some of the origins of the curve, and historically it may very well have been related to the curves available on instrumentation at the time.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so therefore there's a question of using linear results and maybe looking at a restricted bandwidth, for example, from 0 to 50 hertz, and see what level that gives, which is similar to, in some respects, using DBC, but not as good. In Europe, they have a standard, an IEC standard, which is for the measurement of turbines. I have some fundamental problems with how they're doing it and directivity, but in the middle of the document, they have a methodology for assessing tonality from operational turbines. And that looks at doing narrowband analysis of the noise signal and doing some number crunching to compare it, the tones that appear, with the sections without the tones. At the present time, that standard doesn't look at areas below 50 hertz. So some matters that I'm going to be looking at the data this weekend is to see if I applied the same concept but only looked at the frequencies from 0 to 50, whether this would give us a methodology for determining the infrasound and the tonality of that infrasound under the standard which therefore could add a penalty to the A-weighted value.
Stephen, where...
Sorry to be so scientific.
And next week, I'm going to be cross-examining a wind developer as well as noise expert here in New Hampshire. And his position is firmly that there is no infrasound. And so here you are, again, going through this investigation of finding the signature of the wind turbine sub 50 megahertz and identifying it as a problem. And yet the wind industry is not even close to acknowledging it exists. Or perhaps in Australia they are. What kind of pushback are you getting?
There has been a paper or a report that is generally cited by the wind industry in Australia for some studies into infrasound with the claim that infrasound levels around a wind farm are similar to that in the general environment and that there's no significant difference.
Yes.
I referenced it in the paper about the wind farm too close to communities, and it is available on the web. If you look on Google for the same spot and compare what the paper, what the report says versus Google, they seem to have left out about 12 turbines that have been there since 2008, but somehow or other don't appear in the report. If you study the report carefully, it's not clear as to whether they were really testing the wind or the wind farm insofar as the remote locations. And what I did is I attended the spot and took some photos to prove to myself that there's some disagreement with the report. Now, there is acknowledgement in that report that infrasound is generated by wind farms, but they have provided the results in one-third octaves, and one-third octaves, by the nature of the width of those one-third octave bands, do not show the individual frequencies or signatures.
They're too broad. It's too broadly drawn.
That's correct. And if you look at it in the narrow band concept, you see this classic signature associated with the turbines. Now, you have to have equipment that can measure down to 1 hertz, because if you use a sound level meter that does one-third octaves and stops at 6.3 hertz, which is the lower limit in some of the instruments, you're never going to see this. And if you have instruments that stop at 10 hertz, you're still not going to see the effect. And so what I did at one site, I took a measurement of just wind, and it was reasonably windy and puffy, over a 10-minute period, and I provided in that paper towards the end the one-third octave signature associated with the wind and the narrow band signature associated with the wind that clearly shows there is no harmonic pattern that appears. So I have shown that the infrasound that occurs in the natural environment is not the same as the infrasound that occurs in proximity to wind farms. That
there
paper
is,
also... Sorry?
So you're saying that it's that harmonic that distinguishes the wind turbine noise.
Yes, if you look at the Rand and Ambrose paper, they show the same thing. If you look at the monitoring that's occurred for the nuclear monitoring stations, one in Scotland and another one which I've referred to, recorded by German researchers, you can see the harmonic pattern associated with the turbines. You, in some cases, can see it's in vibration in the ground when you're close to it, and you can see it when you move away from the turbines. Now, I've actually got in that paper measurements at a person's house 8 kilometres away from a set of turbines. Now, these turbines are up
air?
On a hill.
Stephen,
that's through the air.
Through the air? And what about through the bedrock? Do you see anything? Or is it different equipment that would pick that up?
It can be same, it can be the same analysis. It's different senses in terms of vibration and that. I have endeavoured in some cases to get some results, but I'm not confident in what I'm getting at the moment because normally I'm not in proximity to turbines. And I'm limited to the amount of gear that I can carry when I'm going interstate on planes. Just simply a weight restriction.
Yeah.
I'm yet to investigate the vibration, but certainly on the work that I've been doing, it's an airborne noise.
Yes.
But if you can get this signature 8 kilometres out from a set of turbines, then it is according with impacts, and these people are having trouble sleeping, and they wake up startled at night.
Now,
Stephen, what does that sound like? I'm sorry, Harley.
No, go ahead.
That sound that you're picking up as far as 8 kilometers away, that's an infrasound. Can you feel it, or is there any audible sound to it?
All right. The situation for this residence that I went to, it is an extremely quiet area. There's no cell reception there. They do have electricity, so that's a plus, but it's extremely quiet. And the background level at 8 o'clock at night was 23 dBA. Now, when you stand outside the house, you can hear this low-frequency hum, and you can get a direction of where it's coming from. And this is not a natural noise to these people that have lived there for 50 years, farming the property. Now, the infrasound components that appear in that paper, you're not going to hear those. You hear the frequencies that are around 25 to 50 hertz, of which there are patterns. And when I first started off the investigations, I was concentrating on those frequencies because you could hear some of those low-frequency noises or tones inside people's houses. But inside, at this house at 8 kilometres, you could hear a little bit of noise. You certainly heard low frequency outside, but I could measure the noise that you can't hear. I had to take out some of the results because I could get a clock ticking 2 rooms away.
Oh,
and
wow.
That was in the signature.
Huh.
Because the interesting thing is that if I use this equipment, it also records wave files, and I can listen to the wave files back in the comfort of my office, but I can add about 30 dB to the noise. And I suddenly hear noises in the room, which I could not hear when I was standing in the room at the time because I've increased the gain.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't hear the infrasound because I'm not going to hear it by definition.
Right. That makes sense.
Okay, Stephen. I had a question. We had I was looking at some of the information about the wind turbine signature, and I know that the noise is coming from a combination of aerodynamic with the blade moving through the air and also the mechanical noise of the turbine itself and that it's moving and the mechanical parts. And I'm wondering if you know of any mechanism other than distance for mitigating the sound, particularly the aerodynamic noise. Is that the wind guys seem to think they might be able to knock a couple of decibels off by changing the speed of the blades or feathering them a little bit and they lose performance. But what options are there other than distance?
In terms of the low frequency, distance is the solution that they have. But the problem that you have is that low frequencies attenuate at a lesser rate than normal frequencies in the audible band. The concept for some people to come to grips with the fact is that imagine if this was an aircraft and the size of the turbines were the propellers on an aircraft. It would be a very, very large aircraft, and it gives you the indication of the amount of force that's involved in that form of propeller.
Mm-hmm.
And so the dynamics of the energy that's passing across the blade are quite significant. Now, in aircraft, they can feather or change the pitch of the blade to change the performance of the aircraft. And these are things that they can do to reduce or optimize the noise that would be coming from the turbines. But the speed of the turbine plus the number of blades going past the tower gives rise to this blade pass frequency, and it will still be there. And the bigger the turbine, the more force that you have, and therefore the more energy that's transmitted over distances.
Okay, so the size of the blade is significant, because they are going to launch, when we find the wind developers moving into lower wind conditions, they are increasing the size of the blade in order to produce more energy.
Yes, and see, what happens is that when they increase the size of the blades, they reduce the speed, because you have to worry about the tip of the blade will obviously be passing the tower at the fastest speed. And as you start to get to high speeds, you can get to supersonic effects. So if you've heard helicopters, the large helicopters have very large blades and very wide, and they create an impact noise when they do a sharp turn. And you normally hear it as a thap, thap, thap. Mm-hmm. That's called blade slap in America, or blade vortex interaction in Europe. And what happens is it's the blade passing through the airflow from the previous blade, because as it turns around, it intersects the waveforms that are coming out from the blades. And smaller helicopters can have a greater number of blades at a smaller diameter to give them the lift, whereas the larger helicopters have larger blades and very large widths of the blade, and also longer lengths to enable them to give the dynamic forces. So in some helicopters, you can hear them 10 miles before they arrive, because you hear this thump, 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 thump. Now, that in effect is the same thing as the turbines, but at a much higher frequency that you're able to hear it. And if people have experienced those large helicopters, they know they can hear them from quite a fair way away. And it's in effect the same mechanism, just at a higher frequency.
Wow. Okay. That's very interesting. So I just had one last question then, and I relate it to the low-frequency sound and the attenuation. Are you familiar with what Denmark has established a new criteria or new guidelines for turbine noise? And it says that this is for outdoor noise, it's a 44 decibel at wind speeds of 8 meters per second, 44 dBA, and 42 dBA at wind speeds at 6 meters per second. But for low-frequency noise, they've said that inside, the turbines cannot produce noise that exceeds 20 dB inside a dwelling. And Vestas, the wind manufacturer out of Denmark, has been very upset about that. And I'm curious because they're saying that they can't meet that without putting significant distances between the turbines and the dwelling. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
Okay. The problem they have at the present time, it's a theoretical calculation for the indoor noise. They're not actually using a measurement. And therefore, the problem that you have in that concept is determining the attenuation, that is the reduction of sound from outside to inside. If you take typical performance of building elements, the testing that they do in laboratories stops at about 100 hertz. So you'll not find information to allow you to do these calculations. I and other acousticians here in Australia have actually sought to do simultaneous outdoor-indoor measurements to find that there is very little attenuation of the low frequency through the building structure. And in some cases, you can get an enhanced noise level inside the room, so that it's actually louder in these frequencies than outside. My papers have shown some graphs, and if you look at the work, it commonly appears as House 10, which is a house 1,300 metres from turbines in South Australia. And at this blade pass frequency in the first few harmonics, the level inside the residence is a few dB higher than outside. And this is a pattern that's clearly detected in the bedroom where the background level is round about 23 dB. The outside level in the background was about 28 dBA. So the problem they have is that a 42 or 44 as an outside will, in remote rural areas, create a noise impact, and they wouldn't have a problem with that level. But the problem of now going down to 22 in a value of dBA, in my view, is inappropriate, as we've discussed earlier about dBA, but still will be difficult to get. And if I can get houses that are experiencing 23 or 20 dB inside the room for an outside level of about 28, then the problem they have is that getting 44 outside, they know will not meet the noise level inside, if it was to be measured. And the appropriate way is to actually measure rather than do a theoretical assessment.
I see. But even if we imposed that 20 decibels, if that were to be the guideline that we pull out of the air and we accept in Denmark, from what you're saying, it would be very difficult for the wind guys to even approach that, even if it's not actually tested.
Well, if they consider an appropriate distance is a few hundred metres, or in your terminology, call it 1,000 feet, then the concept to get the criteria that they're talking about, if they say there's a reduction from outside to inside of 10 dB through an open windows, but at low frequencies the windows don't mean much, then they're talking about an external noise level of 32 dBA. So under their own analysis, if they give you the energy for a turbine, the minimum setback has already gone out to about 1.5 to 2 kilometres for one turbine, let alone a wind farm. So the distances that would occur as a result of that criteria are significant.
Yeah.
But the problem they have is that they don't have the information to determine the noise levels at the low frequency. They've already admitted that their propagation models are wrong for low frequency. So there's a major underestimate of the noise impact, which they get away with by doing a dBA level. If you come back and, for example, said, no, we'll use a linear level inside the house, and I don't believe it's dBG because of the curve, but if we do a linear level inside the house and we made the equivalent of what they're trying to do, it might be down round about 50 dBC if they were to use that, or maybe 50 dBG, or maybe 60 dB linear. That would be an issue that would then allow it to be measured in simple terms, and you may very well then be getting to the point of what is the annoyance, because in the end, the community doesn't want to be disturbed by the wind farms, and if the wind farm operators were responsible people, they would want to be able to operate their wind farm without causing any disturbance. If that was to occur, then everybody would be happy, and that just simply requires people to seriously look at the separation distances.
Right.
Just picking up on something that you had said a little bit earlier, you had mentioned there are certain seismic monitoring stations that were saying that, I think the figure was 30 kilometers away, they had to have a turbine-free zone, essentially, of a 30-kilometer radius in order to not affect their instrumentation. Do you know what I'm referring to? I'm not asking it very well.
There are two studies that have been available, one by researchers in Scotland and another one by researchers in Germany. And what they have identified is that there are stations around the world whose task is to monitor for nuclear explosions, both in the air and in the ground. And to do that, they have a very large grid array of vibration detectors in the ground. And they need that large array to be able to determine very small movements in the ground attributed to nuclear explosions, which give rise to the similar frequencies that are emitted by wind farms. They also do acoustic monitoring, and therefore these organisations have a significant degree of expertise in such measurements. And two studies that I've seen go to the trouble of identifying the attenuation that occurs in these low frequencies, the infrasound components, to show that it is not the same rate as the DBA. They also show, particularly the one for Scotland, to show the vibration which is generated by turbines, and it has the same signature that you can detect in the air. So it identifies that it is the source, and they can measure the vibration at great distances using very sensitive equipment. Now, all they're saying is that for the operation of their facilities, you need extremely large distances so that they are in a wind farm-free vibration stroke acoustic signature. Now, obviously, that's not the distance that's required for the separation of residents, who can be much closer and not be affected, but it shows the degree of the vibration and noise impact that's generated from turbines. And it becomes interesting for engineers that are experienced in doing machine vibration, such as monitoring equipment on industrial plants to see that the pumps and the motors are functioning correctly. They are automatically trained to think in terms of the frequencies that are generated from turbines, the matter of propagation, and to look at these harmonic patterns that show you it's simply a mechanical source that is generating the energy. And so people that are experienced in looking at things like compressors and maintenance, they automatically have thought processes that understand the propagation, the forces that are generated, and the impacts that can occur by operation of such equipment. If they are then trained in acoustics, it becomes a very simple step to understand it. There are people trained in acoustics who are not trained in vibration, so they don't necessarily see the link. But there are standards that we have in terms of vibration all around the world that talk about different levels of vibration with respect to the receiver. And they have a high level that becomes the threshold where there is a serious impact on health and hazard of people in the workplace. Then you can go to a lower level that involves people in their houses carrying out their normal duties. Then you can go to a lower level, for example, people that are on trains and buses so they don't get motion sickness. So we have these different thresholds in the point of vibration, and all that's occurred is the monitoring stations have a threshold which is much lower.
Right. So there must be other kinds of really industrial facilities that they can't site that close to these monitoring stations. Other than just the wind farms, there must be other things that would interfere also. There must be a list, right?
Well, there's a similar problem that's occurred here and in other countries associated with gas-fired power stations. Because the actual combustion of the gas creates this low-frequency energy. And if you get to look at the some furnaces, you can see the furnaces move, or that is the flame in the furnace, move at similar rates. So there are quite a number of instances where residences in proximity to gas-fired power stations can tell when there's a different combination of turbines on, because it physically shakes their house and they can feel the energy that's coming from these turbines, and it's all in the infrasound region. There are similar situations which can be called sick building syndrome, where there are fans associated with heating and cooling that pass a lot of air, and they do that at a low speed, but a tremendous amount of airflow, being very large fans. And in some cases, the ductwork associated with those fans has resonances at these frequencies. So other consultants here in Australia can recall situations where you have a fundamental frequency around about 6 hertz being generated in a building, and it was giving all the workers in the building a significant headache, and some people could no longer work in the building and had to go home. It wasn't a matter that fell into the direct conversation to say, yes, that's infrasound. But when people reflect on these situations and realize that they have actually experienced these things in acoustic engineering a fair while ago, and then look at it in terms of turbines, they start to understand that this is nothing new.
So it just seems fundamentally wrong to me that the wind industry would deny that there isn't any infrasound being produced by these devices. I mean, it just seems beyond, it's just not honest to me. It seems unethical.
I just want to say they take the position that it might exist, but since it's inaudible, it can't harm you.
Right, and that all seems to tie in with, I know you've written about the ethics that are involved in your profession, and I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Okay. I'm first and foremost an engineer, and in Australia I'm a fellow of the Institution of Engineers. I am required as an engineer to follow a code of ethics. I'm also an acoustician, and I'm a member of the Australian Acoustical Society, and they have a code of ethics. Now, both organisations have in their code of ethics a fundamental requirement to protect the well-being of the community. I'm also a member of the Institution of Noise Control Engineers in America, have been for, I don't know, about 25 years, and they also require their members to operate in an ethical manner, and there is a fundamental requirement to look at protecting the community, because in effect, the issue that we take as acoustic or noise engineers is generally about solving problems, and those problems are excessive noise that either impacts on people in their houses, outside their houses, or in their workplace. So that's the fundamental tenet or requirement that we have to undertake. Now, in Australia, when I started looking at assessments that have been provided for wind farm applications, they're typically titled a noise impact assessment. But when I go through the document, I find in all cases, I haven't found any exceptions yet, but I found in all cases, they consider the noise from the wind farm with respect to a criteria that's nominated by the regulatory authority. And that's the end of the story. They don't tell the reader of the document that, A, the wind farm will be audible throughout the day and night, or only in the night in some locations. They don't tell you that when the wind comes up, the noise will be greater. The reader has to look at the curves and have a degree in acoustic engineering to understand what is being said. So what happens is that they don't say people will have sleep disturbance. They don't say that the noise will be so bad that they'll get sick, or that some members of the population will be unable to live in their houses. Now, all of these are impacts that occur as a result of the noise. If we were doing an industrial assessment, and in actual fact, in the applications, they talk about components of the construction noise in the substation, and they look at those with respect to regulations that are held in this country, And they do describe the noise impact. They say you won't hear the noise from the power lines at residential dwellings, or the noise level that will occur from the substation may be audible or may not be audible. The construction noise, yes, you'll hear noise during the construction, but when you come back to again look at the wind farm assessment component, they don't tell you anything about the impact. So therefore, they're actually not living up to the name of the report, because if it says it's a noise impact assessment and they actually haven't assessed the noise and they haven't told the community what they're going to receive, then that has a problem both in terms of the credibility of the report, and also it questions their compliance with the Code of Ethics. And you may say that the wind industry, the operator, has a responsibility to make a profit. That's fine. But the acoustic engineer that is setting forth the application and what will occur has a moral, ethical, and I see by the Code of Ethics, a legal obligation to actually identify what is to occur. And in my travels in various states in Australia, where I've had residents crying about the impact that's occurring, and it's very emotional. They can no longer live in their houses. One property that I went to back in June, they do a 25-mile drive each day to go to work. And what they're doing is their property is their farm, and that's where they work. So they live 25 miles away because in that house they couldn't sleep. Now, the wife noticed the effect of the turbines within a few weeks of them coming online. After some time, the children were noticing it, and I think it's about 6 months down the track, the husband noticed it. And they just simply enter the property, and they get different symptoms. One gets a headache at the back of the head, one gets a headache at the front. But all of their children and the entire family feel sick in their house, and they've left their house, which is a house that they've had for quite a few years, and they now are building a house about another 8 kilometres away, where they have stayed and made sure on an adjacent property that they're not having impacts. So there is something there, and the point is that acoustic consultants have come along to do compliance tests for the wind farm, have been told all these situations, have heard about the symptoms, and go away and say it complies with the regulation. Now, there's an issue about their compliance testing is of concern, because the residents say, well, it's very interesting, when they were here, that turbine, and pointing to one that's about 1,000 metres away, amazingly wasn't operating. There are residents that will tell you when compliance testing is done by persons who are qualified, who are supposed to be bound by these ethics, that turbines are shut down. Or one can find that they can control the turbine blades and change the angle of the pitch to reduce the force on it, so the turbine's going around, but it's not creating as much noise as in normal operations. And so what's being called for in Australia right at the present time is a bill in our upper house of parliament, our Commonwealth Parliament, that if a wind farm creates excessive noise, they don't get their money. That is, they get their money from renewable energy certificates, not from selling electricity. And the bill requires there to be real-time monitoring of noise, wind output, energy for each individual turbine to be available on the web so that the community can see what this wind farm is doing, and therefore allow any independent monitoring to determine the noise contribution from the wind farm and whether it complies or not. Now, the consequences of this bill then leaves them open to prove that they do or they do not satisfy their noise limits. And this is being done by senators trying to get action for communities that are impacted by wind farms around Australia.
Now, setting aside that avenue, which may go forward, and I certainly hope that it does, the Society of Professional Acousticians, I guess, is it the Australian Acoustical Society, is that the official name?
Correct.
Is there going to be a cleaning up of the shop, or are people going to be held accountable? Is there a mechanism by which someone writing one of these so-called impact studies, but not actually writing anything about the impact, is there any way for an internal process there to go forward, or for someone from the outside in the community to bring that to an ethics committee or something like that?
There are a group of residents 12 months ago in response to a wind farm application that formally applied to the society about the unethical behaviour of the organisation that had prepared a report. As I understand it, there was an internal review. As to who was on that internal review and whether they are independent of any wind applications is unknown, but they actually didn't, from the documentation I see, they didn't answer the question, and a reply was provided from a firm of solicitors, and I understand it's been ignored. So the question becomes as to whether there's too many people that have vested interests in these studies that are involved in the organisation to look at protecting it is a question that I can't answer. But what is likely to occur is that ultimately these things will finally be exposed in either courts or if we can have legitimate inquiries into what's gone on, then where people can't duck and they have to provide the correct answers, then the community may be able to get to the bottom of it. Because there's a significant issue of concern at the present time. If a wind farm is given an approval and the approval is presented in terms of guidelines that are in use and the fundamental tenet is that the wind farm is not to create an adverse environmental or health impact, if you end up having a situation that it can be proved that people do experience an adverse noise or health impact by reason of the operation of the wind farm, and that the wind farm complies with the guidelines which are expressed in DBA, then it falls back to the regulatory authority, and they seem to pass the buck up to other authorities, and there is nobody that is accountable or responsible for what's going on. Because you cannot find, in researching the material in Australia, to find the basis of the noise levels that they have applied in rural areas. We talked earlier, if you have a criteria of 35 or 40 dBA and the real background level is down at 20 dBA, then there is no acoustician in the world that can tell you there will not be an impact. Because it's clearly the case that a noise level of 35 dBA or 40 dBA that is impacted upon a rural environment where the background level is 20 dBA, those people will suffer an acoustic impact. And so ultimately, the regulatory authority or the people that created these guidelines need to be put in the witness box and please explain. And when they can't explain, and one finds that the regulatory authority has failed in its obligations to the community, to protect the community, then the question becomes whether it will be class action against that authority. Meanwhile, if the wind farm operator is complying with the regulation, they're all okay under those guidelines. If they're not complying with the regulation, well, that's a different story.
I certainly hope that enough political will can be generated to try to get some relief for the communities that are really being so severely impacted and so unjustly. It just seems to, it breaks my heart, actually, to hear stories like that. People really do deserve to not have their homes invaded by sound for the profit of someone else.
But that's what happens in real life. They do get invaded by sound, but the question becomes is what is a reasonable level? And that's why there is a need to look at studies to show the impact that is occurring as a result of the wind turbines. And it's not a single entity, you know, as a doctor or even an acoustician that can give you that link. You have to follow down all the chain to have a team of people that can prove what's occurring, to go through and look at the effects, how it affects the body, how it affects the mind, their sleep patterns, how it affects their health, what happens over the long term, what happens when turbines are off for periods of time and people lose all these symptoms that they get as a result of the operation of the turbine. So what happens over a period of time for chronic exposure? You talked about earlier about, well, if you can't hear, it's not affecting you. You can do the same thing if you can't see things. The concept of saying that it's not affecting you is falls out of the equation when you start talking about things like X-rays or gamma rays or radiation.
Right, or UV light on a beach.
You know that you can get sunburnt and the skin peels. You know there's a cause and effect, but you don't know what else has occurred at a lower level and what will occur over time. One of the things that you find when you look at some of these limited studies that have occurred about affecting people, you have, in a lot of cases, turbines appearing, say, in Europe on flat ground. There's not many hills in the Netherlands, whereas we've got mountains. And so the situation is that the noise that residents receive for our turbines, which are much bigger than previous studies, you can have people in valleys where there is no wind, there is no noise, other than that that's coming from the turbines on the top of a hill. But we're getting people that are having turbines which are 3-megawatt turbines, and they're getting impacts. And people use studies to talk about 700-kilowatt turbines to show, well, in the early 2000s in Sweden, 35 dBA in the rural area created a serious impact from 700 kilowatt turbines. Hmm. Where's the information about the 3-kilowatt turbines?
Hmm.
It doesn't exist.
Right.
And so you end up with the question that a wind farm operator cannot answer the question in a planning appeal, can you guarantee that your turbines are not going to create an adverse impact, not going to create a health impact, not going to create offensive noise? They can't answer the question.
Mm-hmm.
On our last on the last program that we aired a couple weeks ago, we had the opportunity to interview someone who lives on a bluff, about a 200-foot-tall bluff above the ocean. She lives on Block Island. And they're planning to put six 6-megawatt turbines about, what did she say, a mile and a half away?
That's right, offshore.
So I guess she's going to become part of a natural experiment of some sort to see just how badly she becomes tormented by really a very large turbine. I mean, a 6-megawatt turbine is a huge machine.
Well, one of the things that they need to do is to be able to identify the ambient noise data that exists at the present time without turbines. and they need to look at it not in dBA and not in one-third octaves, but to look at the narrow bands to determine the baseline. The report that I recently prepared for a collector wind farm, I went to the trouble of being on the top of a hill at a residence property, and I did a 10-minute measurement where it was a wind of about 3 metres a second. Sorry, we work in metric over here, with gusts going up to 7 metres per second during this 10-minute sample. I provide a graph of the dBA level over that 10 minutes to show the noise that occurred. Then what I have followed is that I've taken for that 10-minute sample to provide the one-third octave spectra, and I can measure down to 0.63 of a hertz on the instrumentation that I'm using. And that shows a peak that occurs in the low frequency. But then what I do is at the same time, for the same sample, I have the instrument to give me a narrow band analysis where I look at 0 to 50 hertz or 0 to 25 hertz at a fine resolution. And what you end up is a single peak, which is that associated with the wind. Some of the wind farm operators will say there is infrasound in the natural environment, and I agree with that. I don't have a problem. But when you look at the infrasound that occurs from that wind in that environment, and then look at infrasound that occurs from turbines where they exist, there is a signature. And that signature is not the same as the natural environment. So for the resident that is going to be the social and possibly the scientific experiment for 6 megawatt turbines, you have the opportunity now to get the baseline data, both in terms of the health of the individual and the acoustic signature that exists, and then to unfortunately get real data about what happens to a person as a result of those turbines. It also gives the opportunity for the wind industry to do the same thing. So if they were serious about the impact, they would be wanting to involve the community to get to the bottom of this and use this as a test study where they could have a series of monitors going out. They need to provide all the data of the operation of the wind farm, its power, its blade pitch, they call that a SCADA data that comes out. They give that information, and one could start looking at real-world situation as to what's going on. It's a perfect opportunity to develop that, because one of the things, for example, is they do the noise monitoring under this sound power level where it is relatively close proximity to the turbine but down at ground level. And if you imagine that a turbine is a big fan, and if you stand behind a fan, say you have a cooling fan in your office, and if you're directly in line with the cooling fan, you will feel the airflow. If you move to the side, you do not feel the same amount of airflow. And if you move further away, the airflow reduces. So you can physically experience what a cooling fan does in your office or your house. Now, put the cooling fan up on a table and then sit on the floor at an angle below the cooling fan, and you won't feel much air from the cooling fan. Can you visualize that?
Sure.
Now, that's where they take the measurement for the noise from the cooling fan or from the wind farm. That's why you get pictures of cows underneath the wind farm not being evident, because if you sit under the edge of the table, you won't feel anything from the fan. You move back and move up, you'll get the energy and the effect of the fan. So if you're trying to get to the bottom of the noise, you really need to be measuring the noise at a distance from the fan or the wind turbine, and up in the air where you will be in the pattern of the noise from the turbine. If you measure in the shadow zone, and you use that for calculations, it therefore follows a simple engineering science that you're going to have the wrong number to start with.
Yeah, and Stephen, this whole concept of even the pre-construction ambient noise or background noise studies, I know that you had were very critical of the Flyers Creek project, that the location where they put those monitors and the fact that they include a lot of information that probably should be stripped out, like that should be in order to get the background information, like insects and wind noise and other things. There's a pattern of either trying to demonstrate that the background noise level is higher than it really is, or as you're saying, in post-construction, putting the monitors in the wrong location to present a lower noise level. I mean, this is consistent behavior we've seen from the wind industry, where we're not getting honest results, whether on pre-construction or post-construction.
Yes, well, I've asked the question and I haven't been able to get an answer. When they do the wind studies for the siting of a turbine, they put up a mast 10 metres or 80 metres in the air, and they look at getting data for 1 or 2 years. Mm-hmm. When they come to doing the noise assessment at rural residences, they put out a noise logger for 2 weeks. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't look at different seasons. They don't look at what's occurring or the wind direction in relation to the wind farm. They just get 2 weeks of data and they do some form of averaging.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and this is where it's tied up in the noise from the wind farm, because they actually created a scientific anomaly here in Australia. When they went to do testing of the Capital wind farm, they turned the wind farm off during the middle of the testing for the purpose of determining the ambient background level. And the ambient background level at the wind speed that was occurring after the wind farm was there was actually quieter than the noise levels prior to the wind farm.
Even with the wind farm not operating.
When a wind farm was not operating. So I can very facetiously say, build a wind farm, turn it off, and it will suck the noise out of the area to reduce the background. Statisticians will laugh, but that in effect is what they did. And all it says is that the data that they used in the first instance was wrong, because they had a data curve, a set that they had, which is obviously higher than at the time when they came round to do the compliance test. And nobody's answered that question. It's gone into government circles. And so I had down in South Australia, I had a noise monitor with a wind logger sitting on the side of a hill for a proposed wind farm. And there are no trees within 500 metres of the monitoring location. And I actually have 3 months of data where I get the line of the noise versus the wind for the instruments that I'm using. And it actually is a really good straight line. And I've therefore done similar exercises near about 50 metres from trees, and I've done 20 metres from trees. So I can get some answers about what my system creates from the wind, mm-hmm. which means when I do compliance, I can logarithmically take that off the measurements and turn around and say, here's the noise from the turbine. And that's pretty simple in engineering terms to do, because at the present time, if the community can't get the information from the wind farm and the criteria is expressed as a noise level at the residence versus the speed at the hub height of the wind farm, then nobody in the community is independent testing can prove non-compliance if they don't have the data. But if you now have the data to know what the sound system that you're measuring generates as a result of the wind in the scenarios of no trees, 50 metres from trees, 20 metres from trees, you can actually take each of those curves and turn around and say, hold on a sec, here is the compliance or otherwise with the wind farm. You can then look and say, well, when it blows in this direction, you get this noise level. when it blows in the other direction, this is a different noise level. All of that actually exists, and for acoustic engineers that are involved in looking after large industrial petrochemical plants and the like, mines, they're fully aware of the difference in the propagation and the matter about how you do compliance, because they'll measure the noise and they'll look to say, right, which way is the wind blowing? Now, when it's blowing this way, we know we get an enhancement, so yes, it complies with the conditions, or no, it doesn't. It's very simple if you're experienced and carrying out this work with integrity.
Now, do you feel optimistic about this particular problem being solved in the future, or do you feel like it's going to be a hard slog?
Look, it's going to be a hard slog because there's a small population, usually in low socioeconomic areas, who don't have the resources to tackle these industries. It's a very similar problem to that occurred when they introduced jet aircraft to the world. And when the first jet aircraft engines occurred and were flying, there are totally different characteristics to propeller aircraft. And the problem is that it created a significant impact around the world. But there were thousands of more people impacted, and therefore the authorities had to jump on the bandwagon and look into it. They developed new criteria, new assessment for aircraft noise. They developed indices, and they developed planning concepts of how it would occur. And then with the pressure that was there, they then had to develop quieter aircraft. So in the end, it's only if the communities can get together to bring it to the attention of the politicians, because the bureaucracy is not going to care. There are plenty of peer reviews which are just simply literature searches. Nobody's out there actually doing the work. Nobody's held accountable. Until such time as the environmental authorities, or you have to find where the buck stops. And when the community has the wherewithal to get those people to be accountable for what they've done, and politicians are going to lose their job because of it, or the true politicians that are there to represent the people do their job, only until that sort of thing occurs, not until that time that it occurs will anything happen. That's why this Senate inquiry into excessive noise from wind farms is brought about by two senators doing road trips around the country, going to communities and hearing the same story over and over again. Hundreds of people affected by the operation of the turbines. And they've asked me, and I've been to a couple of these meetings to talk. And this is the real world. This is what's happening. And in some cases, the community gets so relieved to find out they're not going mad. There is actually a cause, and there are some people trying to do something about it, and invariably those people are always underfunded or not funded at all, as in my case, and you're trying to do some things. But one of the things that I have found in the travels is there's a spirit of what used to be called the Australian country ethic, and they're down-to-earth people, and they will help you. And I've stayed in houses, and the hospitality that I've got from country people reinforces that spirit that used to exist in this country. And they're just so glad that there are some people that are interested in helping them, that are trying to help them, and maybe we'll get somewhere. I don't know, because I'm just simply a noise engineer, and I'm just trying to do my job, but I'm looking at it. There is a problem, and I don't know when it will be solved, but ultimately the people have to be held accountable that are creating the problem. And that occurs in all sorts of noise problems. If I have to do a noise issue from a hotel, and the hotel's got bands there and creating music and it's disturbing the residents, then my job is to fix it. And it's the hotelier's responsibility to make sure they don't create an impact. And that's what happens every day of the week. And I don't see there's any difference as to why this shouldn't happen with any industry, whether it's a wind farm, whether it's a chemical plant, whether it's a waste treatment plant, whether it's a factory, a hotel, a shop, a commercial enterprise. They still have to address the impacts that they create upon people.
Well, Stephen, you have my admiration and thanks for everything that you're doing, and I wish you the best of luck with your studies and your efforts, and I hope that things go forward and it won't be such a hard slog. Thank you for taking the time out to talk to us.
Thank you very much, and I really am appreciative that some of the work that I'm doing that people are seeing, and it's giving them some idea of what is the biggest island in the world, by the way, what we do down under here. Remember, you are talking into the future at this present point in time. So.
Thank you, Stephen. And I will say one thing. Your article on the ethics made it around the world multiple times. It hit very hard in just the right way. So I'm hoping to use that next week, as a matter of fact, when I cross-examine a noise expert and remind him that as long as he's a member of the organizations, or the professional organizations, he has an obligation. We'll see how that goes. But thank you for that report.
It's not necessarily an original thought. You do have some researchers in America, acousticians who are in a very similar light to me. We've most probably been doing it for a long while. We know how things were done in the olden days. And we had to use our brain a lot more than digital equipment. We understand about dealing with complaints, how people react. And some of those researchers that I've had communication with, and you no doubt have talked to them, also agree with this philosophy. And in the end, I was so annoyed that I had to write that paper. And I'm pleased that it is being looked at overseas. There is a deafening silence from acousticians in Australia here about it, because most probably a large number of them look at that article and realise that all I've left out is their name, because they know that, and it's, if I put the names in, there's a very large list. But there are people who are trying to help the community, and they're trying to do the right thing. And these are people all around the world, and they're basically, well, most probably you'll find they're like me. They're small, one or two man, or up to a five person consultancy. And we believe in what we're doing. We believe we have an ethical and a moral obligation. It's also costing us a bomb because we're not getting paid for a lot of this work, but we believe in our commitment and we believe wholeheartedly in the code of ethics, and we're just trying to do the right thing. So I'm not alone. There are people, and you have some very highly skilled people that have the same frame of mind in America. There are similar people in England, and there's a couple in Europe that are now looking at my information, and they're realizing that they've got some problems, because all the people that have looked about doing DBA and talking about DBA and doing all their assessment in DBA now realize maybe that wasn't the way to go, because they didn't think in terms of the real world, whereas the consultants that you've dealt with, they're out every day solving problems, so they're not sitting in an ivory tower. They understand how you do these measurements. They understand things like frequencies, and it just stares them in the face that they know there's something wrong. Now, if the one thing that can occur from my work is people to realize that DBA is not the answer, then I've really achieved something.
Well, I believe you've already achieved quite a bit, and I'm certain that you will in the future. Thank you, Stephen.
My pleasure.
Take care, Stephen.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Stephen. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Lisa.